America's wealth gap is expected to widen due to COVID-19.
We know, for instance, that women and people of color earn less money and have less wealth. What that means when they hit a time of unemployment, they have simply less to fall back on.
How and why the pandemic is hitting communities of color so hard. That's our top story today on The Takeaway for Wednesday, May 13th. I'm Shamita Basu. Also, we talk with the mayor of Denver about how the Mile High City is weathering coronavirus.
Public health administrators really had us develop strategies, including the stay-at-home orders, that will help us to begin to plateau the epi curve, in which we were successfully able to do. We were able to flatten it.
And a look at the theater industry right now, where all the world's an empty stage.
Like many things, we have persevered and we'll find a way. And it may not look like what we were, what we imagined, but, you know, I think it's important to have a stage from which to tell our stories.
First, the wealth gap and COVID-19.
There is a real risk that you will trigger an outbreak that you may not be able to control, which in fact, paradoxically, will set you back, not only leading to some suffering and death that could be avoided, but could even set you back on the road to trying to get economic recovery.
This week, Anthony Fauci, the country's top medical expert for the COVID-19 crisis, testified virtually in front of the Senate Health Committee. He urged the country to refrain from opening up too early. And he said the death toll from the virus in the United States could be much higher than the reported 80,000 people so far. And as the health crisis continues, COVID-19 has also pushed us over the cliff toward an economic crisis. And we're still bracing for the impact. In the month of April alone, more than 20 million people filed for unemployment in the United States. And that is a staggeringly high number. The U.S. now has an unemployment rate of 14.7%. And to put that in perspective,
we have not seen anything that high since the times of the Great Depression. And even then, the rate took a year and a half to get very high. Here, it happened within a month.
That's Lane Windham. She's the associate director of the Kalmanovitz Initiative for Labor and the Working Poor at Georgetown University. The workers who are affected the most are, of course, those who are working in hospitality and service jobs. And there's something else striking about who's hit the hardest, though it's no surprise to economists who've seen this trend again and again.
We know that people of color and women are the most likely to have lost their jobs. The unemployment is hitting women and people of color even harder.
I spoke with Lane to discuss the significance of these numbers, along with Aaron Ross Coleman, an Ida B. Wells Fellow at the Tite Media Institute covering race and economics.
We know, for instance, that women and people of color earn less money and have less wealth. And what that means when they hit a time of unemployment and when they hit hard times is they have simply less to fall back on. So, you know, the fact that women only make 82 cents on the dollar to what men earn, Black women earn just 62 cents for every dollar earned by men. That means that at times of unemployment, when they lose their jobs, they just are going to be harder hit.
Aaron, can you say more about how these unemployment numbers break down across racial lines?
So when you disaggregate it, it's an even worse picture. Hispanic unemployment's at 18%, Black unemployment's at 16%. You have white and Asian unemployment are both at 14%. And you already are starting to see some of the disparate kind of breakdowns that have happened in past recessions during the Great Recession. It was similarly disparate. National unemployment was at 9%, and then Black unemployment was at 16%. And then going back to the Great Depression, you see similar kind of really big gaps with 24% nationally and 50% for Black people. So there's the old saying that when America gets a cold, Black Americans get the flu, and it's like now we all have coronavirus. So It's pretty tough.
Lane, what about the gender gap? Did unemployment shake out in a similar way in 2008?
In 2008, we saw that job losses were more heavily borne by men, often in the construction industry, for instance. Mm-hmm. This time around, it's different. Women are losing their jobs at a faster rate. The unemployment rate among women right now is 15.5% compared to 13% among men. That's a big gender gap. And we saw a gender gap, although it wasn't as large, in 2008, but it was reversed. So this time, because of the nature of the kinds of jobs that are being lost that tend to be more female-dominated, women are absolutely shouldering a lot of the burden in this round.
Erin, we also saw a very long recovery process take place since 2008. And for many people, that recovery was only being felt recently. How do you perceive it will be for us to bounce back to a recovery from this?
Yeah, I think a lot of that depends on the public policy response and, you know, what policymakers decide to do to intervene. But right now, it's tough and there are a lot of obstacles ahead for a lot of families, for a lot of workers, particularly like Black and brown workers. You know, unemployment was just starting to dip down into the low single digits. You know, that was a talking point that Trump was very proud of, the lowest Black unemployment on record. And that's because you saw a recovery where, you know, more people were starting to join the labor force. Employers are becoming less discriminatory and, you know, who they would hire just based off of race and skill and stuff like that. So, you know, earlier last year, the end of last year, 2019, we were just getting to those really good kind of unemployment numbers where people were being able to participate. And now here we are at the worst recession since the Great Depression.
Lane, right now there's a lot of talk about essential workers. And I'm sitting in New York and here many of those essential workers are Black and brown people. What might a recession look like for essential workers across the country?
One in three jobs held by women are considered essential. So a recovery for essential workers could mean that they have jobs, they have work, but will that work be healthy? Will it be safe? Will it be jobs that they can go to with confidence? And I'd say right now, many of those workers are reporting to work and are really risking the safety for themselves and for their families. And I think that, you know, we have a long way to go before those essential workers who we depend on, those cashiers, those nurses, those EMT workers, are fully protected and are fully safe.
You know, I'm thinking about unions and labor organizing. Lane, have we seen a difference between how unionized workers and non-unionized workers fared during past recessions? I'm curious how labor organizing can possibly help Black and brown people and women specifically.
So there absolutely is a union difference in terms of wages. You know, I mentioned before there's a gender wage gap, there's a race wage gap. Unions close that. And so, you know, a worker who has a union makes more money than those who don't. Women and people of color are even more likely to do better than their non-union counterparts. And so unions absolutely raise wages, increase benefits, and frankly, give workers more say at a time when they really need it at the workplace. You know, you saw that, I think, for instance, in some of the unionized grocery stores. Those were the first ones to have the plexiglass up, to be making sure that there was safety for their workforce. You know, and what we're seeing across the country is that there's lots more interest in unions. Lots of workers have been striking. Just since the beginning of March, there have been over 150 wildcat strikes. These are strikes that are not necessarily called by the union. They are from the grassroots when people feel that their safety is not being respected. And so there have been a number of strikes across the country. And I think there's also just been a renewed interest in general in the idea of organizing and unions.
Like, do we know if there are any organizations or at the local or state level or even local or state level governments that are really bracing for what these unemployment numbers mean? Is anyone truly prepared for this?
I don't think so. I mean, recessions are something that, like, state and local officials really depend on the federal government for support, just because they oftentimes don't have the budgets that allow for kind of deficit spending in order to offset, you know, like cuts to their budget or just, you know, large scale stimulus. So it really often, in my experience, just speaking to economists and politicians, it's something that they're definitely relying on the federal government to help them get through, especially something of this size and scope.
I would just add to that, that in this country, it is very clear right now that the way that we do our social safety net is particularly poorly put together to deal with this kind of a massive pandemic, a huge crisis. You know, workers' health care comes through their employers. Up to 43 million people may lose their health care in this crisis. In addition, our unemployment is bifurcated. It goes through the states. It doesn't go through the federal level at one system. And so, you know, we are particularly poorly suited to dealing with this level of a crisis.
So in the absence of those kinds of social safety nets, like you said, Lane, what are some solutions that we can look to sort of soften the blow of this economic crisis?
I think that in the immediate term, the federal government has to step up. There needs to be more stimulus. We absolutely need that cushion in this country. And then I think that our leaders need to follow where the people are right now, which is that the people are demanding a more robust social safety net. People fully understand at this point why our employer-provided healthcare system is not working, why people need paid sick leave, why we need paid childcare. I think it's very obvious to people. And I think over the next several years that we may see leaders stepping up and beginning to make some really fundamental changes in policy in this country.
What have we learned from the past regarding the impact of recessions and rising unemployment numbers on elections? Like, how can we expect this to manifest itself at the polls this November?
I think one of the interesting things is just the way that this is kind of changing the way people are talking about the elections and the way the candidates are talking about themselves. Like, I think it was earlier last year that Bernie Sanders framed, you know, his democratic socialism in terms of what FDR did. Earlier this week, you see Joe Biden in New York Magazine, I believe it is, you know, framing his presidential candidacy in the terms of FDR. He wants to have an FDR-sized presidency. So, like, I think that's one of the ways previous recessions, especially like even depressions, is impacting just the kind of ways that politicians themselves are thinking about political economy and what they think it'll take to move voters, and also like what they think it'll actually take to pick us up out of this crisis.
It's interesting that Biden says he hopes to have an FDR kind of administration. You know, Roosevelt was pushed in many ways to implement much of the New Deal by working people who struck. There were major strikes throughout the country in 1934. And much of what Roosevelt implemented had actually been test-driven in the states at a local level before it was ever implemented at the federal level. And so I think that it's important to remember in the election that yes, of course, the power at the top makes a lot of a difference, but there is also lots happening at the local level, at the state level, and among working people. And we have to take a broad look during the election season.
Professor Lane Windham is the Associate Director of the Kalmanovitz Initiative for Labor and the Working Poor at Georgetown University. And Aaron Ross Coleman is an Ida B. Wells Fellow at the Tite Media Institute, covering race and economics. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Shamita.
On Saturday, Denver joined the growing number of cities across the country that have begun to reopen. Retail stores and personal services like hair salons and tattoo parlors can now operate at half capacity, as long as they follow the city's safety guidelines. And one of those new rules makes face masks mandatory for anyone in or waiting to get into any commercial or retail business, government or health facility, or public transportation. To continue our series of conversations with local leaders, joining me now is the mayor of Denver, Michael Hancock. Mayor Hancock, thanks for joining us.
Glad to be with you, Shamita. Thanks for having me.
What were the major factors that made you feel like it was safe to begin this phase of reopening Denver?
Well, we had to really, think foundationally. One is recognizing that this virus is going to be with us for a long haul. And we have to learn how to navigate it, really try to box it in for ourselves here in Denver. And with that, the public health administrators really had us develop strategies, including the stay-at-home orders, that will help us to begin to plateau the epi curve, in which we were successfully able to do. We were able to flatten it. We saw a sustained plateauing of that curve, even some decreases in terms of number of presumptive positives, hospitalizations, and deaths in Denver. Mm-hmm. And that became kind of the overall, portrait of how we made the decision that we could begin to slowly roll out operations of the city of Denver with some guardrails, including the mandatory mask.
Yeah, and I want to ask you about that mask rule in a minute, but Dr. Anthony Fauci told the Senate Health Committee yesterday that reopening too soon could lead to, in his words, suffering and death that could be avoided. Did hearing that give you pause at all about how you're going about reopening Denver?
Absolutely. We wanted to make sure, and we had it in our mind anyway, that as we think about opening up the city, what are going to be those guardrails that help us to kind of make sure we manage the spikes? We know there's going to be more presumptive positives. We know there's going to be more cases because we're testing more. But how do we make sure we're able to manage it as opposed to the virus managing us? And that's really the thought, the mindset we went into it with. And that's why you see things like wearing masks. That's why you see things like still no more than 10 people in one place. If you go into a beauty shop or a salon, it's by appointment only. No one's waiting. You cannot sit and wait in the salon while your appointment is pending. Mm-hmm. And so those guardrails are important, again, to try to manage the transmission of the virus going forward. And then, of course, stepping up our game in terms of testing as well as contact tracing.
With that rule about face masks being mandatory in many public situations, how are you enforcing that rule?
It really is voluntary compliance. We recognize and have tried to spread the value that when I wear my mask, I'm helping you, and when you wear yours, you're helping me. And so people recognize that when two people are in each other's vicinities and wearing a mask, we drop dramatically the possibility of transmission of the virus. And so education has been really the key for us. And I'll tell you that, inspectors are out and about. The police are aware of this, but it's really the people and the value of saying, the best thing I can do for my neighbor is to wear this mask. And the best thing that neighbor can do for me is to wear the mask. And when you go into the stores, as I did this weekend, I can tell you that 99% of the people were wearing masks, and people were appreciative that folks were wearing masks. Mm-hmm. Those who don't, they really stick out like a unicorn right now. And we want to keep it that way for a while. We want to have the value and the culture of mask wearing for a while.
Hundreds of homeless people in Denver tested positive for the coronavirus last month. And at the end of April, you cleared out homeless encampments, despite CDC guidance saying not to do so unless individual housing was available, which it was not. Can you explain the motive behind this decision, Mr. Mayor?
Yeah, Shamina, let me correct the record. We did not clear out the encampment. Actually, since the CDC guidance came out, and it's just that guidance, we have allowed for small encampments to develop in the city of Denver against our own policies. What we did at the end of April was to go in and clean the encampments. Our public health team had identified, unfortunately, that some of the camps had deteriorated to where there were public health threats. And that's something we simply cannot tolerate any more than we can tolerate the unnecessary, willful, transmission of the virus in Denver. It's just a public health threat. And so what we did was we moved in to clean the encampments. People were asked to move their belongings so that we could bleach or sanitize the sidewalk and pick up the elements that could be that could endanger people's health and safety. And then they were allowed to come right back. If they didn't want to move, we cleaned around them. But as the threats persist, we're going to continue to go in And we may have to move folks from one side of the street to the other so that we can create the public health threat. We simply will not tolerate for public health threats to exist in the community, because it's not only a threat to the people who are homeless, experiencing homelessness, but it's a threat to the general public.
We've talked about concerns for unsheltered people in this moment on this program quite a bit. And there have been concerns raised about these congregate shelters as being really unideal circumstances for people to be in during a pandemic. What were the options given to people who are who were staying in these homeless encampments?
We try to move them indoors, including some of our respite care locations, which are some of your traditional shelters, but also some additional new ones that we've opened up that give you larger space within the confines of our dealing with the COVID-19 challenge. So they had over 100 square feet or 60 square feet in which to be cared for. But we also opened up some hotel rooms that we, as much as we can gather together for the hotels that have become vacant or shuttered as a result of COVID-19. We have been in negotiation to open up some of those rooms. We have close to 600, over 600 of those rooms available. So those who may be exhibiting symptoms are more vulnerable because of their age, for example. We have moved those into hotel rooms or offered hotel rooms to them.
I wanted to ask you, Mr. Mayor, about that face mask rule. Have you received pushback from your constituency about that rule? We've seen protests in some other parts of the country against similar guidelines.
Right. Not widespread. We've had isolated incidents where people have refused to wear them going inside facilities. And basically, the local or the operation security has pretty much handled it. But we've not had widespread, you know, you hear comments here and there from people on social media. Maybe one or two people walked into the office, but nothing that would cause us great alarm.
Mm-hmm. And regarding the homeless encampments that we discussed earlier.
Yes.
So what happened to the people who were temporarily displaced by what you're describing as being cleaning happening at the homeless encampments?
They were allowed to stay there. Most of them just moved to the side or, you know, maybe across the street while we cleaned that side of the street. And they were allowed to come back after the cleaning was completed. You should also know that we have opened up 24/7 congregate care shelters where we're also randomly testing members, people who are experiencing homeless, as well as several other respite shelters and hotel rooms to take care of those who have been tested presumptive positive. So we have been pretty aggressive in terms of providing indoor space for our people experiencing homelessness in Denver, but also allowing, again, for the smaller encampments to occur in the city.
Denver Mayor Michael Hancock, thank you for talking with us.
Absolutely. Have a great day.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
Some scientists warn that for the first time in centuries, the southwestern U.S. is in the midst of a mega drought. That's according to a new study published in the academic journal Science. Mega droughts occur when a region has experienced severe drought conditions for a long period of time, usually across multiple decades. As concerns grow over the coming wildfire season on the West Coast and how the coronavirus could affect their response, we talked to Park Williams. He's a climate scientist at Columbia University and one of the authors of the new study. Park, thanks for joining us.
Thanks very much.
So tell us, what exactly is a mega drought and how does it compare to a regular drought?
Mega droughts were really first discovered in the 1900s. In the early 1900s, tree-ring scientists found these phenomenal droughts evident in tree-ring records. And these droughts that occurred during the medieval period back about 1,000 years ago through about 400 years ago happened repeatedly And what the reason we call them mega droughts is because they are bigger than and longer lasting than any drought that we have seen in modern times. And that means that modern society, which really developed in the 1800s and 1900s, is probably not tuned to a mega drought. And so while mega drought may have a bit of a nebulous definition, the one thing we know is that a mega drought is unlike anything that we saw in the 1800s or 1900s.
And you're saying that this is something that shows up in tree rings, like when you cut into the stump of a tree and you're able to study the rings in that tree trunk. How is it evident in the tree rings?
Right. As trees grow, they put on an annual growth ring every year. And a big wide ring in the tree trunk means the tree grew a lot in that year. And if the ring is skinny, it means it grew a little bit. And in the West, generally the primary limiting factor on life is water. And so in years when water was not plentiful, then the tree rings are skinny. And it's not just one tree that'll have a skinny ring. Essentially, all the trees across the West will have a skinny ring. And so we can use these sequences of skinny rings and fat rings like barcodes to see how drought varied in the past.
That's so interesting. So how do you define that a mega drought is currently happening?
Well, we can use these tree ring records to see what drought was like almost up until present. But of course, many of the tree ring records we're collecting or that we're using were collected back in the 1980s and 1990s. And so we can extend these tree ring records of drought with actual observations of drought based on climate data all the way up through present. And what we see is that right around the year 2000, the bottom dropped back out of the bucket and the West began drying. And we know it began drying because we've seen Lake Mead and Lake Powell in the West declining. We've seen explosive increases in wildfire activity. We've seen these giant bark beetle outbreaks. We've seen rapid extraction of groundwater. And so we've known this drought is bad, but it's been tough to tell exactly how bad until now. And what our assessment shows is that the drought that began in the 2000s, even though there have been brief breaks, just like the mega droughts had, this drought that began in 2000s has been on par with the worst two decade periods of the worst mega droughts that occurred about 1,000 years ago.
And where exactly are we seeing these extreme drought conditions? Like what states or parts of states are affected?
Our analysis covers what we call southwestern North America, and it extends across most of the western continental U.S. and also includes northern Mexico. It goes up as far north as southern Montana, and it goes down as far south as a couple hundred miles into southern Mexico.
Park, what is responsible for these extreme drought conditions that we're seeing today, and how much of it can be attributed to climate change?
We've known for decades now that generally when droughts occur across the West or anywhere, the main thing that it takes is just bad luck. The atmosphere just teams up against a part of the world. What we call an atmospheric ridge forms, where storms are not allowed through and things dry out, they get really hot, and you get a drought. The main purpose of this study that we did, how much of this drought was just bad luck and how much is due to climate change, meaning how likely is it this drought is really going to continue in the future? We imagined a hypothetical world and we recalculated what drought would have been like without the warming trends we've observed over the last century. And what we see is that, yes, the West still would have been in a drought over the last 20 years without the extra 3 degrees Fahrenheit of warming, but the drought wouldn't have been nearly as severe. In fact, the drought that would have occurred due to just bad luck and not climate change would have been about half as severe as the drought that was actually observed. It wouldn't be going toe-to-toe with the mega droughts that we see in the tree ring record from last millennium. And that is really important. It's going to take less and less bad luck to fall back into severe drought in the future. And it's going to take more and more good luck to pull ourselves back out of drought in the future.
What about the implications for the people and the wildlife who live in that region? What has this drought meant for them?
We have seen wildfires increase, especially in forests. Since the early 1980s or so, we've seen the annual area of forest fire increase by a factor of more than 10, meaning that there's more forest burned in an average year today than there was about 40 years ago. We've seen massive bark beetle outbreaks, which have been promoted by severe drought and temperatures. And we've seen major limitations on how much water is available. California, for example, had to instate really aggressive water restrictions. We've seen big shifts in agriculture. What we've seen is agriculture using more water out of the ground. Groundwater is a backstop to buffer against the consequences of this drought. And because groundwater takes a long time to replenish in many places, this is an unsustainable activity, meaning that in order to have a more comfortable drought right now, we've been borrowing from our resilience to drought in the future.
Do you have any concerns about what the emergency response to wildfires will look like during this pandemic?
Once again, across the majority of the West, including a lot of our forested areas, the Sierra Nevadas, the Central and Northern Rockies, the Cascade Range in the Pacific Northwest, these areas are abnormally dry right now, and that generally promotes fire. And so unless these areas are bailed out by a wet summer, fire activity is going to be, fire potential, the flammability is going to be really high. At the same time, a lot of fires are set by people on accident. Will there be more people out in nature during this pandemic or less? I don't think we quite know yet. What we do know is what you were just suggesting, that the ability to respond to fires may not be as strong as it is in normal years. For example, training camps for firefighters have already had to be altered or canceled because of the pandemic. And so will firefighters be able to have the same response this year? I really don't know, but what I'm reading is probably the same as many. That is that the response is probably going to be weaker this year. And so we may see some bigger fires, but that's yet to be seen, I say.
Park Williams is a climate scientist at Columbia University. Park, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
COVID-19 has forced performing arts theaters across the country to halt productions and close their doors. Broadway has announced it will remain dark until at least the fall. But for smaller arts organizations, the picture is much more dire. Most theaters don't know when they'll be able to reopen to audiences. Many aren't sure they'll be able to stay afloat until then. And the communities that depend on these theaters have, at least temporarily, lost essential spaces for art, education, and simply coming together. But even if theaters are able to reopen within, say, a year, it's far from guaranteed that audience members will be quick to return. A recent poll by the market research company Shugal Research found that only about 36% of theatergoers in the United States think they would go back to their old theater-going routines once performances resume, which means it'll be a long time before many theaters can bring in the level of revenue they were making before the pandemic. And that reality comes on top of cancellations they've already experienced this spring.
The day we shut down was the day our gala was meant to happen. And then the Monday following, we were to begin rehearsals on The Wolves. So we lost a production and a gala.
That's Paige Price, producing artistic director for the Philadelphia Theater Company. In Los Angeles, the country's oldest Asian American theater company, East West Players, was at a similar point in its season. Here's their producing artistic director, Snehal Desai.
The evening we closed, we were about to start previews for the musical Assassins by Sondheim as part of a citywide celebration for his 90th birthday. And it was also our biggest musical of the year. And then we also were about to launch our Theater for Youth tour, which hits tens of thousands of kids in Southern California. And like Paige, we were weeks away from our gala as well, which had to be canceled as an in-person event.
I spoke with Snehal and Paige about what COVID-19 has meant for their arts communities, as well as how their own employees have been affected financially by these cancellations.
I think the financial impact was, A, what to do with the folks that were on payroll for the show. So we had folks who, once you go into performance mode, who work front of house, who are crew, And those folks are paid in a different way than, say, actors and have different contracts and stuff. And so it was a decision of how long to pay those folks out. You know, we couldn't, unfortunately, pay them out for the full run, but we were able to pay them out a little bit. And in terms of our full-time employees, we were actually okay because that was our last show of the season. And then we were in our gala season and we had a lot of our gala income in. The trouble we're running into now is our community has been very patient and very gracious about giving us time to see when things will be able to operate again. But as the timeline looks further and further out, now we're getting more calls for refunds. And so it's just a concern of how much we're going to have to kind of return.
Paige, what about for you?
Yeah, we're in a similar position where we waited a little bit because so much was happening so quickly that this week's worst case scenario was next week's best case scenario. So we put everyone on hold. And once it became apparent that the unemployment was going to be generous, we furloughed almost the entire staff and we helped the part-time workers around the front of house. We helped them get some emergency grants that were happening. And then with the actors, we found out when they were available in the fall, which of course now is the best case scenario. Mm-hmm. And so now we're looking at ways that we could possibly do something with the actors online so that we can pay them an equity salary and showcase the play in some way. In fact, we thought we'd even go to the writer and see if there's any kind of work she'd like to do to reimagine it for Zoom, and that way we can pay her something too. So just trying to find ways of closing that loop and giving our ticket holders something to look at. And many of them have donated back. I was pleasantly surprised by the amount, about 58% donated the money back to the theater. But as Snehal also mentions, you know, as the timeline grows further and further away for when we'll gather again, we're just trying to figure out how to stay attached to our community.
And Snail, I know that East West Players has also been thinking about online content, like Paige mentioned. Have you been able to produce or plan anything like that?
We have. We took our time a little bit. It felt overwhelming, the surge of things that went online immediately. And sure. So we wanted to see what we could translate. And we have this series called EWP Presents. We have this series called Crazy Talented Asians and another one called Asian AF. And so we've been able to take some of those programs virtual. And it's great. You know, a lot of them have a variety show aspect, multiple singers and comedians and stuff like that. We've been able to take that online once a month. And then we just launched East West Wednesdays, which is kind of like a weekly different conversations with artists in our community. We just had one on Asian American comedians with Margaret Cho and Randall Park and Susie Nakamura. But we also interviewed doctors who were Asian American who were on the front lines to talk about their experiences.
Paige, I know that you've been having conversations with different artistic directors in other places in Philadelphia. What kinds of conversations are you having? And is everyone sort of dealing with the same issues here?
It's really interesting. Philadelphia is like, I was only there for 3 years now. This is the end of my third year. And there's such an enormous community there. And it ranges from individual producing artists to almost, I think we have 7 LORT institutions in the area, which is a lot. And so we started with a couple people and the list has grown. So more than 70 leaders are on this call now. So you can imagine the scope of issues. And they're similar to how do we take care of our artistic community? How do we take care of our staff? What do we do with programming? And I have to say there's a lot of forward motion since the group is so big now, we've broken up into 5 subsets of issues like reentry and sharing resources. And one group is called Dreaming Forward. What are the innovations that might come from this moment? I'm having another conversation with other peers across the country that might involve producing something. And who knows what that looks like. That word is very amorphous at the moment. Making something in Philly that maybe people in Seattle could look at, giving people access to other artistic communities by sharing a platform. And so I'm talking with at least 4 other theaters all over the country about something like that.
Snehal, I'm sure that you've been having similar conversations. You're in LA. I wonder if you're talking to artistic directors at other local theaters in LA or beyond and what you found helpful?
We also have had great leadership from the city and the county. So they have convened kind of working groups to have conversations, and particularly across the performing arts spectrum. So with dance, with music organizations and things like that, since we're all dealing with the same concerns about how to safely bring our artists and our audiences into the building. And the real question that, you know, I think that's been kind of ruminating is, what will our audiences also need after all of this? You know, how do we honor the, you know, at this point, it's almost 75,000 Americans who have lost their lives in a very short span of time. And what will that look like? For most theaters, you know, your base audience is actually in the high risk category of individuals above 60. And our traditional income streams of ticket sales, subscriptions, holiday shows, and in-person fundraising events is not going to be reliable for a long time. So as Paige said, it is going to have to be a really hard look at the model, both the business model and the artistic model, to see what is going to serve, you know, our communities in the best way possible. So for us, we also are looking to move outside the building. We're looking to take our work more into, say, the senior homes and things like that, so that we can bring something to communities that have been most the hardest hit and we may not be able to see for a while.
Paige, I wonder what kinds of specific conversations you're starting to have about reopening and what that would look like.
It is really interesting.
That was a telling sigh.
Well, I think that, you know, Snehal started down the road of what kind of emotional state are our artists going to be in, our audience is going to be in. You know, I worry about the sector. You know, we have 55,000 full-time equivalent jobs in Philadelphia. And I sort of think of them as the motherboard that's underneath the city, the cultural motherboard. And if that shorts out or if we lose a big chunks of it, I fear for the vitality of the city, because we are going to be one of the last businesses to open. We're going to be the last areas of Pennsylvania to open. And so we're just looking at what could we do to the building itself. And we're budgeting structural changes. We know that Actors Equity is going to give us some guidelines for the artists backstage that will be global, which is great that they have somebody on that case. But really, what is it like to walk into a theater and expect to be taken away and have a whole front of a house staff in a mask? You know, but is that comfort inducing? Is that, there's so much unknown that we're just sort of making a different plan every week. But it's starting to become a little bit more clear how many pillars that we're going to have to put up underneath our productions to make people feel safe.
Snehal, I'm sure you have lots of thoughts on what reopening might look like, but I'm also wondering, given the level of xenophobic and racist language that's been used against Asian Americans during this pandemic, has that entered into your thought at all in terms of the mission of your theater going forward?
Yes, I would say every day. I think the hardest thing right now with what we're dealing with is that we understand that humans are a social creature, and we're just not able to have that interaction with each other, and it's going to be a very long time. I think that's a vital part of the services we provide. We are community centers, and the further apart we are, there's an increasing lack of empathy and there's an increasing rise in the rhetoric. So for us, it's been about making sure our community stays visible, that we speak out against kind of the hateful rhetoric, and that we also educate our community on how to protect itself. But, you know, you cannot deny the significant rise in hate crimes throughout the country. And even in Southern California and in LA, we've seen an increase in incidents on a daily basis. And so for us, it's those things. And then for me down the line, how will I keep my community safe, my patrons and artists as they come back into our space?
Mm-hmm. Some theaters have already announced that they've had to make the difficult decision to close their doors permanently due to financial pressures from COVID-19. I'm wondering to both of you, what would the loss of live theater mean in your respective communities? Maybe Paige, can you start?
You know, I don't believe that live theater will go away. I'm not there yet. I certainly think that there's an expectation that theater will thrive in some form. It's been around, you know, somebody I hear on your Zoom call to the communities now, somebody, maybe it was Michael Ritchie, mentioned that it was the second oldest profession in the world. So I'm on that camp. I think it's going to stick around for a while. It just might look differently. And, you know, if I'm really honest, I think that there was a subscription model and many parts of our institutional theater models that needed a good look. And, you know, if we need to take this time to correct and to rethink, I'm trying to look at what that might bring to us to keep our art form vital. But I can't imagine not having live theater. I just can't.
Yeah, I just want to concur with Paige. I think we will survive. And I think, you know, we're in a period, as I say, of forced innovation. And many of the things that our sector has put off in terms of bringing things online and virtual experiences and stuff, we're doing, and we're doing in a much faster way, and we're becoming much more nimble organizations. For East West, we are the largest and oldest Asian American theater, but we're also the longest running theater of color in this country. So I feel like we have a significant role to play in the ecosystem of theater, but also both locally and nationally. And so, like many things, we have persevered and we'll find a way. And it may not look like what we were, what we imagined, but, you know, I think it's important to have a stage from which to tell our stories.
Snehal Desai is the producing artistic director of East West Players in Los Angeles, and Paige Price is the producing artistic director for the Philadelphia Theater Company. Thank you both so much for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We've also been hearing from you about how arts institutions in your communities are being affected by the pandemic and why that matters.
I'm worried about the Oregon Shakespeare Festival. They will have no 2020 season. On top of that, wildfires in Southern Oregon last year deeply impacted their bottom line. I worry about whether the theater will survive, and I worry about the livelihood of the artists, hotel, and restaurant workers who rely on its success. This is Patty Farrell from Portland, Oregon.
Hey, this is John Cooper. I'm calling from Longmont, Colorado, just north of Denver. Losing our arts and culture would be awful. Hundreds of thousands of people over decades have worked and struggled and volunteered and donated to build these places, and they contribute so much more to society than many people think they do. I think it would be a tragedy to lose them.
This is Hannah. I live in New York City. I work on Broadway. The local arts and culture institutions are my community. If we lose them, even just for a long enough hiatus, a large portion of my family will leave my community forever. Either get jobs in other fields that are able to reopen or else physically relocate. Losing my arts and culture institutions means losing my community, full stop.
Erica Pock, Peoria, Illinois. We are doing virtual tours of galleries, and we are doing massive amounts of fundraising for our two community theaters. This would be a horrible loss for our community, considering one of our community theaters is the fourth longest running in the nation.
Hi, this is Bill from Long Beach, Washington. The music venue my wife and I have is closed right now, as are all the theaters and art galleries in town. We've been doing open mics and local artist concerts on Zoom. The sound quality isn't great for most people, but it beats no music at all. The arts are a real important part of the community here on the Long Beach Peninsula, and so everybody is more than determined to get it going again.
Hi, my name is Cindy Henry. I'm from Portsmouth, New Hampshire. Unfortunately, they canceled the Prescott Park Music Festival, which happens all summer and brings amazing artists to the community and really great theater for kids. It's definitely going to take a toll on the local economy and basically the morale of the community, because we love summer in New England. We hope that they bounce back, and we're going to figure out ways to support them throughout the summer.
That's all for us today. Remember, you can weigh in about local arts or anything else you heard on today's show by calling us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. I'm Shamita Basu, and this is The Takeaway. I'll talk to you tomorrow.